So how are you doing on that New Year's resolution to lose a few pounds? Well, I'm not doing the best at it either. But we will get some financial motivation to work a little harder at it during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good to have you along on this Tuesday, January 29th. We'll also get some advice today on finding a financial planner who is right for us and some information that we should know about recent changes to Social Security. And of course, lots of room for your personal finance questions too at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Joining us, as he does almost every Tuesday at this time, Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC, with offices in Eau Claire and Madison, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
So, are you getting a port on in Eau Claire?
It is a 40-square-mile skating rink up here, and I had several fender benders and accidents along the way. Might have brushed past a couple pedestrians, but I'm here.
That's right. It's a little. There is some freezing rain going on in parts of Wisconsin. So do take care. It's very foggy too. So everybody, take care.
Are we doing school closings today or not?
No, we're not. But
okay, because I can just start reading them off if you'd like.
I did want to ask you, as we finish up our series on ways to spend less while you lose more weight, I know that you put together some facts and figures for us. Figures, get it, Kevin? So you have some financial motivation for us.
That's right. These are some of the ways, you know, and those of us who are trying to lose some weight, especially as part of a New Year's resolution, this is usually about the time when we tend to give up and slide back into our bad habits. So we thought we'd put together some information on how a few extra pounds can cost you some extra bucks. And when we do this, we're going to be using a definition of obesity according to Body Mass Index, BMI. And there are some problems using that calculation as a determination of what a healthy weight is. First of all, obviously, if you've got a lot of muscle weight on you, you can be extremely fit, but you can have a very high BMI, body mass index. And it's, people a lot smarter know more about this than you and I do, will tell you that you can be a few pounds overweight and still be extremely healthy and be in great shape. And there was a study released right at the end of the year, which gave many of us hope, that said that actually a few extra pounds can extend longevity and strength. So, you know, lower weight shouldn't be an ultimate and all-being goal, but it's more about getting fit. But when we talk about these terms like obesity, we're using a body mass index usually, and we will have a calculator up at onyourmoney.com that you can put in your height and your weight, and it will tell you kind of where your BMI fits into the particular categories.
Yeah, and I would think that there's a difference between having a few extra pounds and being obese. And
a few dozen extra pounds, right?
Yeah, right. Healthcare costs need to be are probably our biggest expense if we are extremely overweight.
Yeah, the Center for Disease Control calculated that a person who is overweight usually pays about $1,400 or so more per year in extra health care expenses. And then the Mayo Clinic did a study on their own employees, who you hope would know better and be in pretty good shape. And what they found is that their numbers were even higher. People who are considered overweight pay about $1,800 per year. People who are obese, according to BMI, pay about $3,000 more per year. And people who are morbidly obese with a BMI over, I think it was 40, pay about $5,500 per year in extra health care cost. And the way that health care and health insurance is going, we're more likely to shoulder the burden of our own health care costs. And it also may make it even harder to get insurance if you do have to go get it on your own. And if you can get it and you're very heavy, you're probably going to end up paying more just because of these very figures.
So where else do we feel the financial pain?
Other insurance policies, you might try to get long-term care insurance, disability insurance. We're going to talk about that in a few weeks. But oftentimes, you'll have to be measured for height and weight. But where most people really feel it is in premiums for life insurance policies. People who are a little heavier don't pay too much, maybe $14 more per year, a George Washington University study found. But people who are obese can pay $111 more per year for life insurance premiums. And again, some companies may even deny you if they feel that your extra weight is really threatening your health and your life expectancy, and therefore you're likely to die earlier and collect on your beneficiaries to collect on this insurance. That said, you should not use the extra cost or denial as an excuse to not get life insurance if someone else is depending on your income. If you're working, sometimes you can get life insurance without a health exam that would preclude you from getting it. You might also get it from like an alumni association or some other professional organization to which you belong. If you are healthier, though, you definitely want to purchase it on your own, because if they're not screening for weight, you'll find that they'll artificially raise the premiums up to cover it, to make sure that, you know, that they can make enough money off of charging people, and taking into the fact that they're not going in depth and targeting each every person for the actual cost for their weight. If you are going to get life insurance, and I think many people are probably underinsured, you should try to drop some weight if you can before the exam, because that if you have a 20-year term policy, let's say, that extra weight could cost you thousands of dollars over that term policy, and dropping 10 pounds might save you that amount.
And that's not all. There are other places that extra work weight can hurt us financially.
Yeah, that's right. It's harder. The bigger you are, the harder it is to find clothes that not only fit, but that are in your particular size and that look good and feel good to you. So you usually end up paying more for the clothes as time goes on. And airlines, ever cost conscious, are starting to charge people if they can't fit into the narrow 17-inch seat and also get the seat belt comfortably pulled on top of them. They're looking at people and say, you're too big, you're taking up too much room, therefore we're going to have to charge you for an extra seat. And then finally, even in earnings, several different studies we looked at found that sometimes heavier people earn less money than people who have a more normal body weight, if you will. Doesn't affect men too much, about $17 a year or so in earnings, up to $75 for men who are obese. But females, the same study we referred to earlier, earn about $1,900 less per year if they are calculated as obese. And there could be discrimination. They didn't really have an exact answer as to why. But it's something that you're not only spending more money, but you may be earning less as well.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for every investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a money matter on your mind today, a personal finance question that you would like to run by Kevin, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And it is time now for the On Your Money email bag. And Kevin, lots of listeners have emailed us recently asking how to find some personal finance advice. Steve wants to find a fee-based financial planner for his daughter, Sue, who lives in the Fox Cities and has been dumped by her financial advisor and needs to find a new one. And Carol says, I love your show, Kevin. Enjoy. My husband, who died recently, had a notebook in which he took notes on your advice. Kevin, I guess I'll have to continue that and listen more closely than ever. And she continues with, Kevin, you've advised going to the National Association of Personal Finance Advisors website. But if there are no financial planners listed there in my city, what other criteria to use to find a fee-only planner? Would a tax accountant be a good source of advice? What do you think, Kevin?
Well, the CPA isn't actually that bad of an idea, especially if it's someone whom you trust. I do prefer that people have a CPA and an attorney and a financial advisor if they have a more complex situation, because then you have a bunch of separate experts working together, hopefully for your benefit. But if the CPA does have some expertise, and or maybe he or she has someone in their office who does financial advice as well, that could be okay if the CPA can refer them, or they can find someone else in town who does the work as well.
So where else can she or the other listeners go to look for financial planners in a particular area?
Well, most people do have an attorney or a CPA they can check with, or you can also go online. The aforementioned NAPFA site is napfa.org, N-A-P-F-A.org, and then fpanet.com is a search engine for fee-based financial planners. And then finally, cfp.net will help you find a certified financial planner, hopefully in your area. And now keep in mind that the CFPs may not be fee-based, but they'll often will be, and they often are willing to work with people under an hourly or a fee-based arrangement. But some CFPs do have more of a, you know, the old traditional commission way of helping people and charging them commission on their investments.
And if all of those resources don't turn up any good candidates?
Many national firms provide free or fee-based planning as well. I'm talking about like the Fidelities and the Vanguards and Schwabs and Ameritrades of the world. USAA is another company that does this, and it's usually free, or it might cost maybe a few hundred dollars or so to do this. Now, keep in mind, you're often going to be doing this online with people or over the telephone and corresponding via email, but some of these companies do have offices staffed with real live human beings in, you know, Madison or Milwaukee or the Twin Cities or Chicago area.
Any options for do-it-yourselfers?
There's no real great solution out there right now that is all encompassing for all things financial, kind of what, you know, all of our different topics here. But Mint.com is one of our favorite ones, M-I-N-T.com, in terms of calculating not only what you're spending, but where your spending is going, tracks debt paying, helps you know what you should be paying down on your debt. And then also for asset management, there's a place called financialengines.com that will oversee a portfolio for a small fee, usually, you know, 0.5% a year or so, and give you some advice on where you should be moving your money based on your particular investment options for it. Now, again, you're probably not going to get a lot of hand-holding, personal interaction for it, and those types of companies don't have more of a, for lack of a better word, a holistic point of view about all things encompassing. You're more likely to get that from an individual financial advisor.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Carol, for your email and your kind words. And we are so sorry for your loss. And Carol mentioned that she recently lost her husband. And I'm presuming, Kevin, that she'll want to find a financial advisor that she can really trust in a time like this.
Yeah, I am very sorry, and it's very heart-rending to hear about the babbling that you and I do here is actually being written down by her diligent husband. And it's very sweet, and I appreciate that. I will say this. People who are going through this situation where they have lost a loved one, and especially if it was the loved one who was doing most of the overseeing, most couples especially have one person who's kind of in charge of the finances either by default or that person has more of an aptitude or interest. If you've lost that person, my best advice is to first do nothing. Just, you know, take an inventory and an assessment of kind of where things are, rather than saying, you know, someone called me up and they said I should do this right away and I'm worried about, if, you know, making a mistake. Usually there are very few times in this situation where taking time, relaxing, going very slowly and very deliberately aren't the best things to do. And many times people come to me and say, well, he managed all this or she was in charge of everything and I don't know what to do with it. Sometimes putting it in a CD, making sure it's FDIC insured, not only makes sure it's safe, but it gives you the time that it's going to take for the CD to mature to kind of mull over what you will do with the money if and when you need to do something different once the CD matures.
And Steve, who wanted to find a fee-based financial planner for his daughter, mentioned that his daughter had been dumped by her financial advisor. Do Do you dump clients, Kevin, if you don't get along? What's that all about?
Well, I shouldn't say that. I've done this for 25 years. A couple times I've had people, I said, you know, it's not dumping, but it's more about, hey, this, you know, I'm not the right person for what you're trying to do. And that's actually when people do contact me. Sometimes they'll tell me what they want, and I'll say, I'm sorry, but I'm not good at that, or there are probably better people for that particular need. But there is a problem with trying to find good people who do this kind of fee-based financial planning, especially trying to find one who is local. There aren't many people out there, and we're even going to stop taking new clients just because so many people are looking for this kind of service that they have a difficult time finding someone who does this. And I'd recommend, I'll tell you what, if you've got a kid, somebody in high school or college or grandchild who says they're going to be a lawyer, tell them to think as well about being some kind of financial planner, because the jobs are very similar, but you don't have to go to law school. You don't have to graduate with $150,000 of debt. And the financial planners I know are generally quite a bit happier with their jobs than many of the lawyers I know.
If you have a question for Kevin McKinley, you can email it onyourmoney@wpr.org. Maybe it will be used today. Maybe it will be used for an upcoming email bag segment. You can also call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I will buy you a garden where your flowers can bloom. I will buy you a new car, perfect, shiny and new. You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Vicki in Milwaukee starts us off. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. I have a question about refinancing, and I know it's most of the time it always sounds like a good idea. My current rate is at 5.125, and I will be able to refinance at 3.3. And it's going to cost about $1,600. And I just want to know if there's like sort of a break point at which, you know, you're paying, you know, is it going to, it's going to be a 30-year mortgage. Is that okay? Do I have to stay here till I die? Or it's a condo, so I probably will be here till I die.
Okay. No, actually, Vicki, I think that's wonderful. I'm very glad to hear that not only that you are able to refinance for that great level, but that you're doing this for $1,600. Many times people, when they do go to refinance, find that, you know, there are so many different fees and expenses piled on top of it that the cost ends up being several thousand dollars. And a good rule of thumb is to say, all right, how much more money am I saving per month? Let's say you're saving probably, I guess maybe $150 per month or so in mortgage costs?
Actually, my it's not really going to be that much because I don't owe a lot on it. It's probably only going to be more in the neighborhood of $40 or $50, so that's sort of the other consideration,
okay.
I guess.
All right, let's say it is $1,600 in the total expenses to refinance. And you're saving $40. Well, you know, you can divide $1,600 by 40, and the number you get is how many months that you'd have to live in the place to make the initial expenses offset it before you're at the break-even point. But, Vicki, are you just refinancing the balance you owe on the mortgage?
Yeah, I think that's, yeah.
Okay. One thing I would suggest is if you're short on cash, or you feel like you might be making a bigger payment coming up, like you know, some kind of new car, a bigger purchase, or you're going to be remodeling the condo or something, I would sure encourage you to actually get 80% of the loan to the value of the condo, and just park that extra cash in a savings account or CD and use it for those upcoming expenses or for even short-term emergencies. You probably will lose out a little bit on the interest you're paying on the mortgage versus what you will earn on it. You don't want to go out and take it and try to, you know, beat the mortgage rate, because there aren't safe investments right now that pay higher than that mortgage rate. But the access to all that cash and having 360 months to pay it back whenever you want to, and you can pay it off whenever you want to, is a nice luxury that if interest rates rise, and they will at some point over the next 30 years, you'll be very glad that you refinance for as much as you were able to do. So I think you would definitely go ahead with it for what you've told me so far, but I'd really like to see you consider getting an actual 80% loan to value for the mortgage.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks very much, Vicki. Next, we go to Mary in Pewaukee. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Kevin. Hi, Joy.
Yes, what's your question?
Hi, Mary.
My question is that I will be 62 this year, and I found out that you can apply up to 3 months before your birthday. Also, I'm wondering, I have a part-time job, so I work 2 days a week, and I make somewhere under $10,000 a year. Is it going to be more beneficial for me, actually, in the long run, to quit working? Tell me this. No. continue working. And I suppose it might make a difference on what my husband makes and some of our other financial details. But typically, what would
be? I think you can get a pretty good answer on this, Mary.
Okay.
First of all, sometimes there is a penalty if you earn too much while you're under normal retirement age, which in your case is probably 66, but also collecting Social Security. And that number for 2013, I think, is about $15,100-something that you can earn before your Social Security checks will be penalized. And even if you do go above that amount for earnings, you only lose $1 of check for every $2 over that $15,000 amount, and you'll get that back after you reach normal retirement age under most scenarios. So I just as soon have you get the Social Security if you and keep the job and see if, you know, after you that those Social Security checks start coming in, if you say, you know what, we can actually live on this, and the job is a hassle enough where it's not worth the extra money, we don't need it that badly, so I'm just going to let the job go and start collecting the Social Security checks. I think that's probably a prudent move. Again, not taking into consideration your husband's situation or the other financial details of your life.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Good luck, Mary. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And since Mary brought up Social Security, let's move right into our smart assets segment of the show. Kevin, you say that there have been some recent changes to Social Security that both future and current recipients ought to know. What's going on?
Well, I appreciate Mary, too, planting these callers and
yes.
Hiring professional actors to ask these questions has really come in handy, makes the show run even more smoothly than
exactly.
It usually does. Yes, some of the ones we've covered in the past few weeks here, they are going to raise the payroll tax 2% of wages up to $113,000. The average worker is going to pay about $1,000 more in Social Security taxes in 2013 than she did last year. And also it increases the covered earnings amount, that $113,000. But the good news is for retirees, they're raising the checks 1.7%. That will average out to about $20 per month for the average Social Security recipient in retirement. And they've also raised the earnings limit, as we mentioned with Mary, up to $15,120 that you can earn under normal retirement age while collecting Social Security before you're penalized. But there are some other changes that are a little more subtle, but will definitely affect the way that both retirees and workers interact with their Social Security.
All right. So what's new for retirees?
Well, your check is not in the mail, at least not anymore. As of March 1st, they are going to move to a direct deposit only method of transmitting those funds for retirees and other beneficiaries. That's something that's kind of been in place for a long time, but they finally shut the door and said, we're not going to be sending checks out anymore, in part to combat fraud and also to make sure that people are getting their money on time and getting it on a direct deposit. Most people already do get this check as well, but some people are still getting the paper check. For those of you, or if you have know someone who doesn't have a bank account, they will also charge up a debit card as well. But the banker or credit union checking account is the best way to go. And if you have a concern about it for yourself or for an older loved one, go to GoDirect.gov, GoDirect.gov, and they'll give you all the information you need about setting up that automatic electronic payment.
And what's new for current workers?
Well, you can actually see your statement again. For you know, the longest time they would mail out, usually once a year, those paper statements that would lay out all of your earnings over the last several years. For Social Security purposes, and also a slight calculation and a very rough estimate as to what you might receive at different stages and ages for your Social Security. Like, let's say you started taking it at 62, you'd get this amount, 66, 70, etc. They stopped sending those out. And the conspiracy theorist in me said they stopped sending those out because they didn't want people to start expecting money that they may not receive. The Social Security Administration, of course, said that this was because they were trying to save money. And I said, well, why can't they? Why can't you just do this online so people can at least look at it? It's not because of my question, but they did start setting this up online. So if you go to ssa.gov/myaccount. ssa.gov/myaccount, you can look up your Social Security statement online, which is a great idea to do, not just for accuracy, make sure that they're incorporating all of the earnings you have in there, but also, more importantly, for retirement planning. Social Security is a crucial component for many people for surviving in retirement, and so you need to know what you have coming to you. So go and check and incorporate that into your financial planning.
Well, good. I'm glad. I missed those statements, and I think they did listen to you, Kevin. So thank you for that. There's also been a lot of news and new ideas regarding changing Social Security payments and taxes. Anything we need to know about that right now?
Yes, we need to know that there are absolutely no changes whatsoever right now. We heard a lot of rhetoric, especially leading up to the election, about changes that needed to be made to the Social Security system. And the only change, again, being that change in the payroll tax, which will probably hurt people's pocketbooks in the short term, but it will help shore up the Social Security funding for the time being. There's no crisis offhand, immediately anyway. Down the road, we're talking 20 years or so, depending on the different figures we use in the scenarios, there will be less money coming in than there is going out, but there are still several trillion dollars in the Social Security trust fund right now, and making these kind of cuts to Social Security or increasing taxes are wildly unpopular on a political basis. There is one change that did happen. It's very, very subtle, but it does affect more and more recipients every single year, and that is the level of income that you can have before your Social Security payment in retirement is considered taxable income. They set those figures, Joy, in 1983, so 30 years ago, and they've never adjusted them for inflation. And this is by design. It was. They know exactly what's going on when they do not raise these up. They're hoping to snare more and more people and collect more and more income taxes off of Social Security payments. Technically, Social Security payments in retirement are tax-free, but there is a means testing to say if you have other income from Social Security and other sources, then your Social Security can be taxable income. So they did not raise those up again. Therefore, they're going to ensnare more people just from inflation.
And there you go. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money. Certified financial planner Kevin McKinley has information and advice on your money, and he'll answer your personal finance questions if you call 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Justin in Green Bay is with us. Hello, Justin.
Good morning, Kevin. Good morning, Joy.
Hi.
When I was in college, there was one year where my parents took a Parent Plus loan out. After I graduated, I was making payments on those just the same as it was my loan. They ended up filing for bankruptcy about 2 years ago. I was unable to track that loan down for quite a while once I finally did find where it was. Basically, I wasn't comfortable making payments on it, just dealing with the company that had that debt. My question for you is, should I try to find that debt? Should I try to make those payments right now? or let that bankruptcy pretty much just figure itself out.
You're not responsible for it, is what you're saying legally? And
correct.
On
legally.
Paper anyway, you just feel kind of morally and ethically responsible?
That's correct.
Well, it depends. Can you make the payments?
Yes.
Okay. That's a good question. That's one that you have to answer, and it really, you know, on an individual basis, those questions, that's something we really can't answer. I think you should try to do it, because here's what happens, and there's a big movement afoot to say that people should be allowed to discharge student loans and education loans through bankruptcy and more easily, because people are graduating from college or grad school or whatever with tens of thousands of dollars of debt and not enough income to pay for it. And that's fine on an individual basis. The problem is then, of course, that lenders, it will make it more difficult to get those loans if everyone can just say, okay, well, now I've got my degree, which I can use. You can't take the degree away from me. It's not like a car or a house that you can repossess. So you have to ask yourself that question. Can I do this? Can I repay it? The right thing to do is to try to repay it if you can. Legally, you're probably not on the hook for it. But, that's a great moral and ethical question. I'd sure like to see you do it. I think, Justin, you sound like a kind of person, based on this phone call and the fact that you listened to On Your Money, you're probably the kind of person where it actually does bug you a little bit to have that loan outstanding, even though technically you're not on the hook for it, right?
Correct. I guess from a security standpoint, the fact that that debt has moved around to various locations over the past year, I'd say, it's still, it would be considered secure to still pay that. I mean, given that debt's being bought and sold and moved around, should I try and essentially follow that where it's going, or?
I would make your best effort to do it. And what they're doing is, and this happens with all kinds of loans, mortgages, et cetera, that are sold to different properties, and it's an asset to the buyer and to the seller of the loan, and just because it goes from one place to another, people get very frustrated. They say, you know, I took out this mortgage, I refinanced, and next thing I know, I get a thing in the mail saying some company in Georgia has now got this loan. Well, that's what happens, and you probably own a bunch of these loans in a mutual fund or a pension account if you're subject to that. So it is what it is, and I'd really, you know, if you can do it, Justin, it's not going to create an economic hardship for you. What you might want to do is see if there is a way that you can work out something with the lender where you can say, look, I'm going to try to make this right even though I don't have to. Is there a way that we can, you know, either minimize the debt amount or we can slow down the payment schedule or whatever so that I can do something I want to do and what feels right to do, but I can do it in the easiest way possible? And my guess is once you track down the people who actually own the loan, that they'd be interested in hearing what you have to say.
Thank you very much, Justin, for the call, and you're a good guy. Way to go. Next we go to Steve in Marinette. Hi, Steve.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My question is, will a TIPS ETF drop in value as interest rates rise?
What is TIPS, Kevin?
TIPS, that's a great question, Steve. TIPS are, it's an acronym short for Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, and these are securities, Treasury securities, are very safe from a payor standpoint because they're technically government bonds. And the interest rate that they pay is subject to rising and falling according to an index, kind of like the consumer price index. In theory, then, when interest rates rise, the bonds themselves will become more attractive and less volatile because the interest payments are rising up as well, as opposed to a fixed interest rate bond that will probably drop in value when interest rates rise. My guess, Steve, is TIPS have not been around long enough and not during a sustained, steady rise in interest rates that it's difficult to tell. What I think will happen is that TIPS ETF will drop, but probably not as much as one that holds just straight fixed rate government bonds. So there may be some extra safety to it, but there still is risk to it. Do you own this already, Steve, or is it something you're considering purchasing?
I already have some.
Yeah, so you know the price can rise and fall, right?
Yes.
Okay. It's not a perfect hedge against inflation because of that very nature. They can rise and fall, and an ETF is an exchange-traded fund. It trades kind of like a stock, but it's like a mutual fund in that there are lots of different securities within this share price. So, yeah, I'd say it can offer a better hedge against rising interest rates, but not a perfect one in that the price can definitely fall if rates do rise.
All right. Thanks, Steve, for the call. Good luck to you. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. We'll take more of your calls in just a moment. Take more of your calls after we also conclude our series on spending less while you lose more weight. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
My mama told me you better shop around. Oh yeah, you better shop around.
And now it's time for the final segment of our series on spending less while you lose more weight. And we turn our attention to the latest gadgets that will supposedly help you drop some pounds. What kinds of gadgets, Kevin?
Well, these are often, and this has been something that people have often foreseen in the future, and different ones have come and gone. Nothing that's really stuck. We said, boy, that's really the one that's going to be here, but they're evolving at such a rapid rate that I'm guessing that that this is going to be a part of our lives for several reasons. And some might work, others might seem silly, but we may not have a choice in the future, especially if someone else is paying for your healthcare, whether it's your employer or a health insurer or even Medicare, and they might be very interested in making sure that you maintain the best health you possibly can, not just so you stay alive and are healthy and happy, but also so you don't incur a lot of extra healthcare costs that we've referred to before. And there are many new different products out there, and a bunch of new ones just came on the market in the last few weeks and are coming out in the next few weeks as well.
All right, so what are some of the most promising new products?
Well, it depends on what you're trying to track. There are a couple different versions that track your movement and your exercise. Amigo is one that's really interesting because it you put it on your wrist and then you attach another little small component to your shoe, and then it can tell what you're doing from about 100 different exercises within the database. It costs about $119, AMIIGO, and then it will tell you how much calories you're burning out, and based on your heart rate, based on your movement, etc. Another nice one is the Fitbit, FITBIT, costs about $100. It's a clip-on, and they have a wristband coming out soon, so that that will also track your exercise as well. And finally, this is when I have kids. I know that if we were struggling with them trying to exercise and maintain a healthy weight, they would go for this. It's the iBits Power Key. So it's about $50 or so, and the kids get a virtual pet within this key that they can use on the key or online. And then the more that they move around and exercise and are active, that unlocks virtual goods for them so that they can, you know, feed the pet or give it clothes or whatever. So it's a good motivating tool if kids need one more reason to get out and run around.
Oh, my goodness. So if they don't exercise, they're not going to be able to feed their pet.
Yes, the pet dies. That's right. And hope, it's a horrible, painful death as well. And just to,
I don't know. I'm not laughing at that.
No flushing down the toilet, no burying in the backyard.
Yeah, that's well. That'll be a good motivation, I hope. What about those of us who want to watch and reduce what we're eating, our calories?
A couple different ways, and there are several different apps that that you can use to do this. And it's very interesting because if you have a smartphone with a camera on it, you can actually scan or take a picture of the barcode of the product that you're eating, and it will tell you, it will have all the data already in the app so that it will tell you the calories, fat content, all the other ingredients there. And once you put in how much you've actually and honestly eaten of those potato chips, it will tell you just how many hundreds of miles you have to run to work off the calories that that you've just ingested. Another one is loseit.com. This is one of the most popular smartphone apps out there. There's a basic version that's free and a premium version that costs about $40 a year. Loseit.com. And finally, this thing was really interesting to me. The Happy Fork, HAPIFORK. It looks just like a normal fork, except with a very thick handle. Cost about $100, and it monitors your eating speed. So it vibrates so it regulates when you can take another bite, so that you're not just shoveling food into your mouth while you watch TV or read the paper or whatever. And it says, hey, slow down. And if you slow down, not only will you probably enjoy your meal more, but you'll eat less and feel more full and therefore hopefully lose weight.
I saw a feature on TV about the Happy Fork, and the reporter didn't seem to be shoveling it in, and it was vibrating. So I think a lot of us eat a lot faster than we really need to be eating.
Part of it is time. Part of it is also that, it tastes good. And so it's difficult for those of us Americans, if you will, to just say, hey, I know this is a good thing, but slow down and you may actually enjoy it even more.
Right. What about those of us who are trying to lose weight via an old-fashioned diet? Any word on which one might work best?
That was interesting. I saw a couple studies that showed fewer and fewer people actually admit to being on a diet. And in the sense of saying, this is a very special meal, regulated meal plan that I'm using. And part of it is, I think, because people just are generally eating healthier. This mm-hmm. isn't something that they're honestly doing as a real, I can only have a cup of cottage cheese for breakfast kind of thing. But and then, of course, this being January 29th, many of people who started the year on diets are already off them here. But Consumer Reports came out with an exhaustive study, polled their members and said which commercial diet plans were the most popular and gave the highest rating from the users. Weight Watchers was number one. Metafast was number two. Jenny Craig was number three. And Nutrisystem was number four. So if you are going to spend the money to do it, and sometimes that can really help, Weight Watchers might be where you want to start.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and if you have a question for Kevin during this edition of On Your Money, you can call 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let's take Sandy in Milwaukee next. Hello, Sandy.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Hi, I have a question regarding mortgage. We are staying in a rented house right now. But in future, we wanted to buy a home. But I don't know anything about mortgage plans and whatever the cost with pricing on the internet.
Oh, Sandy, I'm so sorry. You were waiting for a while there, and we have a very poor telephone connection. But I believe Sandy would just like a very brief house buying 101 lesson, Kevin. Where should she start to, know what she's doing when she goes into this process of buying a house?
There are lots of different things out there, both commercial that are free. Many lenders in a different area will partner with realtors to talk to people and get them educated on the different processes and ins and outs of buying a home. But there are also several government-sponsored nonprofits that do exactly what Sandy is trying to do here. One is you can go to HUD.gov, HUD.gov, and then we'll put up a few other links at onyourmoney.com where people like Sandy who are interested in buying a home, and this is a very good time to buy a home if it's right for you, where you can go to get some of this information and kind of get educated about it so you really know what you're doing. It's a monstrous purchase, but I can guarantee that people less resourceful than Sandy have been able to do it and have been very happy buying a home, so I think she can probably too.
All right. Thank you, Sandy, for the call. Kevin, the Wisconsin Realtors Association last week said that home sales in Wisconsin registered double-digit gains in December of 2012, sales up 11% over the previous December and up nearly 21% for the entire year. He said it is a good time to buy a home in Wisconsin. I mean, is the housing market on the rebound? Is this the time to act because prices have bottomed out finally?
Well, it's probably a combination of prices dropping and interest rates dropping at the same time, which most people look upon affordability as a home is not so much as the price of the home, but what the monthly mortgage payment will be. And lower prices plus lower interest rates generally do generate affordable homes. The problem is that actually right now there aren't a lot of homes on the market, and so what I think is going to happen is unless we see a bunch of sellers come to the market in the next few months, you will see prices continue to rise just on the basics of supply and demand.
There we go. Next we go to Kurt in Menominee. Hello, Kurt.
Hello. Say, Kevin, I have some questions regarding long-term insurance, long-term care insurance. I've been told or heard that, you can hold off until you're age 60 and don't really need it before that. But I know you've mentioned some other guidelines as far as, you know, if you have so much in your retirement account, you probably don't need it. And so what are those guidelines?
Well, as a rule of thumb, Kurt, if you have less than $200,000 of liquid assets, you probably can't afford to use your limited income to pay for long-term care insurance. And if you have more than $2 million of liquid assets, I'm talking paper assets, not your home or other real estate, then you probably can afford to what's known as self-insure, meaning I'm just going to, if I go into the nursing home, I'll start drawing from my savings to pay for my care. Everyone between that area, and most people are between that area, especially in retirement, should consider long-term care. But don't look on it as, all right, I'm going to start buying this when I'm 60 so that when I'm 85, it will be there for me and I can cash in on it. Think of it instead kind of like your homeowner's insurance where, you know, 2012 went by and most people who owned homes paid for homeowner's insurance and did not use it. And very few people complained about that because nobody said, oh, shoot, you know, a big tree branch didn't drop down or our house didn't burn down. Darn it, that was a waste of money. Look at long-term care insurance in the same way. If you are going to get it, look upon it as, you know, almost a good waste of money, if you will, meaning you not only don't have to go to long-term care and go into a facility, but also you didn't have to spend the money for it. Part of the reason I say that is because many people will not ever need long-term care. They will die in their sleep or in a hospital or some other place, and they won't be in a facility. Other people won't need it for very long. The average stay in a nursing home right now is probably about 11 months or so. Other times people would prefer to stay at home, and they want as much money as they can to have on hand for it. And finally, many companies that offer long-term care insurance right now will probably not be in the business 10 or 20 years from now, just because it's a very difficult type of insurance to price affordably, and it's very difficult to know when people will need long-term care, how long they'll need it for, what type of care they'll need, and what it will cost at the time. So it's something you should buy, and if it feels good to buy, but don't expect it to be the kind of thing to say, good, we're done with that, now I'm taken care of forever, because the chances are that either your situation or the coverage will probably change before you actually need it, if you ever do need it.
Thanks very much for the call. Kevin, we have time. Let's fit in one more quick question from Chris in Kenosha, who says, on a previous show, you mentioned a website where we can find out the value of items that we would like to deduct from our taxes, things like donations of clothes and household items to Goodwill. What was that website again?
It was itsdeductible.com, itsdeductible.com, but actually now that's a service that was bought by TurboTax from Intuit. But TurboTax, It's Deductible, is online, and it's free. You do have to register, but then you put in different items for it. It not only gives you an idea of what those items are probably worth, gives you some reasoning if you're ever audited by the IRS, but also allows you to keep a paper or electronic record of all those donations in case you're audited down the road. So you can go to TurboTax if you want, but it's easier just to type in itsdeductible.com. And if you can't even do that, just go to onyourmoney.com, and we'll have that website on later up today.
And what is our website of the week?
SS Income Planner is an affordable way to figure out all your different Social Security options and what the best one is for your particular situation. Should you take it now? Should you wait? Should you take spousal income first? Should you file and suspend? SS Income Planner costs about $10 for individuals. And again, we'll put that up at onyourmoney.com sometime around lunch this afternoon.
All right. Sounds good. You know, Kevin, we did last week ask listeners to contact us if they wanted you to weigh in on a personal finance dilemma or debate. We are still waiting for you to contact us, so you can do that on your money at WPR.org, because we'd like to see if we can develop this future segment for the show where we have Kevin weigh in on and help you decide some financial debate that you're having with a significant other. Kevin, you're going to be off next week, but back the week after that. I hope you have a nice day off the radio show anyway. Time for four more words before you go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Thanks for joining us. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.